I'm Denise Crosby, and you're listening to the Mean Joe Grizzly Podcast.
Hey, it's Tom Matthews from Return of the Living Dead and Friday the 13th, Part 6, to name a few. And you're listening to the Mean Joe Grizzly Podcast. Enjoy.
Hey, guys, Tyler Mann here, and you're listening to the Mean Joe Grizzly Podcast.
Hi, I'm John Russo, screenwriter of Night of the Living Dead. Welcome to the Mean Joe Grizzly Podcast. Enjoy.
Let me introduce myself. I'm Joe Grizzly, bitch.
What up, Mean Militia? I'm Mean Joe Grizzly, and when I'm not trying to escape a cursed town in a prequel to a remake to a horror classic, trying to exorcise two demon-possessed children in a legacy sequel, or going back in time to stop a mass killer, I'm at the Grizzly Cave, watching movies, reading comics, listening to metal, and of course, crushing beers. And I am here to bring y'all some more spooky season shenanigans with my reviews of three new releases. We will head to Ludlow, Maine for Pet Sematary Bloodlines, a prequel to the 2019 Pet Sematary remake. We'll head to legacy sequel territory that is 50 years in the making with The Exorcist Believer. And then finally, we'll be heading back to 1987 in the time travel slasher Totally Killer. But before we get started, I want y'all to take a second and follow the show on all social media platforms, as well as joining my Mean Militia on the show's official Facebook group by clicking the links down in the episode description. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the show on whatever platform y'all listen on. By doing this, y'all support the show and help me continue to talk to y'all about all forms of badassery. So let's head to Ludlow for Pet Sematary Bloodlines. This is Grizzly Grade Reviews. So, Pet Sematary Bloodlines is a prequel to 2019's Pet Sematary remake, and it's giving us a look into the life of Judd Crandall before it was tainted by the evil of the Knickknack Burial Ground. Or so it should have been. this movie's... Let me say something nice about it first. So, it looks great. It looks really good, actually. It's a good-looking movie. I think that it is competently directed. And going along with it looks good. The cinematography is nice. And that's really all I got to say about it. Moving right on along to the negatives. All the performances in this movie are either they feel phoned in or just completely and utterly bland. Judd in particular is so bland that unless they tell you that it's Judd, you wouldn't even be able to separate him from the rest of the minor background characters. He's just really, it's just not a good performance. It's just not good. The other thing too is not one damn person in this movie has a Maine accent. and I'm sorry, but that was like, to me, that would have been like the most obvious detail to get right, especially from a character who is like the epitome of a Maine accent. Like, that was the big thing about his character. His character was written that way. His character was portrayed that way by Fred Gwynn in the original Pet Sematary film. I mean, even John Lithgow, when he reprised the role as Judd Crandall, he even had somewhat of a Maine accent. He had something. He just wasn't this normal dude. Yeah, nobody in this movie has that. And that kind of... that I know that that sounds like that's nitpicking, but nah, man. It's essential to these characters. Moving on to... they take some liberties in this movie with the lore. And it's just fucking stupid. And it's... quite frankly, is again, this review is pretty much a rant. It's not like this isn't necessarily a review. This is just me shitting on this movie, because I am a big fan of the original Pet Sematary film, and I am a big fan of the novel. It's one of my favorite horror novels of all time, and it is legitimately a classic. It's like a must-read book for any horror fans, and especially people who love Stephen King. So yeah, I'm going to be ranting about this, and y'all guys are just going to have to deal with it. So yeah, when I say it's being disrespectful, it just they take liberties that are just unnecessary. Like, one thing in particular that really stood out for me that was just completely made up, and I made sure that I confronted big time Stephen King fans. I even Googled it, and I could not find anything from the novel that I couldn't remember it. And I've read this novel several times. I've seen these movies several times, and I could find this anywhere in any lore. You have to destroy their eyes to actually kill the people brought back from the Mi'kmaq burial ground. That's bullshit. It's bullshit down to the core. And I seen this one YouTuber that gave his review on it, and he actually seen this at a film festival. And I remember him saying that after they showed the movie at the film festival, the director and the cast and crew were kind of there, like, talking about the movie and how it was made and whatever, and the director actually said that she took liberties and deliberately did this, that, and other. Well, lady, this was stupid. I don't even know why throw that in there. Makes no damn sense whatsoever. Furthering on my rant here, there's no emotion whatsoever. At all. The attempt of showing some kind of emotion comes in the form of, like, there's a brother-sister group of characters here, and one of them gets buried in the Knickknack burial ground and comes back as one of the, you know, evil undead. And they tried to do some kind of connection, emotional connection with that, to try to, you know, justify that, hey, our movie has heart and emotion. And it fails to capture any kind of emotional impact of the original story or even the remake. And I know I didn't hate that remake, but one of my gripes about that remake was, my two biggest gripes about the remake was, is they revealed their hand too quickly in the damn trailers, because for some reason these companies want to reveal every damn thing they can in the trailer now. So they revealed their twist and their big difference in the remake version of the Pet Sematary in the trailer from the get-go. So there was no twist with that. And it just lacked emotion. And even that movie had more emotion than this. And this is a prequel to that remake. So it just fails to capture that emotional impact. That original story is so damn emotionally draining when you read it, because it deals with grief and loss, and this movie had none of that. It had no emotion. It was soulless. It was boring as fuck. That's another gripe. If you're going to make something off the wall and not capture any essence from the original, then at least be like Pet Sematary 2. I mean, I know people hate the Edward Furlong Pet Sematary 2. I don't mind it. Yeah, it's not as emotional as the original one, and it doesn't have the same impact. But they did something different, and they had Clancy Brown had a phenomenal performance in that movie. Do that. Don't do this shit where it's just this phoned in paint by numbers fucking horror film that just so happens to be a prequel to a beloved horror story. And I hated it. And finally, they need to stop this bullshit with making these lifeless sequels from all these intellectual properties. If you cannot make a competent sequel that at least pays respect to the source material, don't fucking do it. Don't do it just to be a placeholder for, okay, the rights are coming up soon. We better churn out a piece of shit movie so we can hold on to the rights for a little bit longer. Or make a quick buck. Let me just throw out a sequel to that because people will go see it because of the name. These studios have to be held accountable with what they're doing with these intellectual properties. And I'm not just talking about in horror. I'm talking about in everything. Marvel is a big culprit of that right now. So DC is as well. So Warner Brothers and Disney, I'm looking at you too. We got to stop just churning out these movies just for the hell of it. We got to start putting some heart and soul in these damn movies. But overall, Pet Sematary Bloodlines brings absolutely nothing new or interesting to the table, and it's just a bunch of bland performances, unnecessary lore changes, and it has no emotion whatsoever. It's just a lifeless prequel to an almost lifeless remake that is it's just disrespectful to fans of the book and the original film. So with all that being said, I'm giving Pet Sematary Bloodlines a very generous 2 out of 5, and it is not Grizzly Gray guaranteed. So now with that out the way, that was not necessarily a disappointment, more as it was a disrespect. Now I'm going to move on to the disappointment, probably of the year, and I really can't say it was the biggest disappointment because I didn't have high expectations from the get-go, but now we're going to move on to The Exorcist Believer. The Exorcist shocked and scared the absolute shit out of an entire generation and more 50 years ago, and since then there have been 4 sequels and a TV show, and the quality has varied from worst film ever made to phenomenal sequel that in some fans' eyes rival the original, to completely forgettable, with the majority of them falling in the bad or completely forgettable category. So with the bar set at an all-time low for sequel expectations, Blumhouse purchased the rights and they paid a whopping $400 million for these film rights, which is just fucking mind-blowing to me. And obviously, they bought them to produce more Exorcist films. And then, in a predictable move by Blumhouse, they announced that this was going to be a legacy sequel, keeping up the current trend in horror of direct sequels from horror classics. So, completely ignoring all films that came after the original, which, in my mind, was a solid move considering that the only good Exorcist sequel in my eyes is The Exorcist 3. So I had decent expectations for Exorcist Believer when, in my eyes, they could only go up. And after watching, I unfortunately have to say that this was the second time this past weekend that I was disappointed. And again, I say disappointed with, like, take that with a grain of salt, because I didn't really have high expectations for Pet Sematary Bloodlines or Exorcist Believer, but I had a little bit more for Exorcist Believer, especially after seeing Saw 10 and seeing how great they did with that. I had high expectations for both of these in that sense, because I was like, maybe it's going to surprise me, and I was let down twice. So let's go on to the positives. And I feel like a broken record at this point. This is almost like the film's too long problem that I have with almost every film this year and over the last couple of years. But it's a very well-made film. It has structure. It's shot very well. It's edited very well. It's got beautiful cinematography, and David Gordon Green did a good job with that. It's got decent performances. Leslie Odom Jr. done very well. He's probably the standout performance of this movie. Lydia Jewett and Olivia O'Neill did great as the two possessed children. Their performances were actually very surprising, because I kind of expected them to be, you know, complete like CGI puppets the whole time, and they actually did a lot of the stuff themselves. At least it appears that they did. The first act of the movie is great. It reminds me of, there was a movie that came out not too long ago called Prisoners, and it starred Jake Gyllenhaal, Terrence Howard, and Hugh Jackman, about two little girls that got kidnapped, and Paul Dano was the lead suspect in the whole thing. But I digress. It reminded me a lot of that. That movie's fantastic. Go watch that movie. The first act of this movie is very similar to that, and I felt like it was a perfect way to set this movie up, giving you this new, fresh way of the possession taking place and everything. I thought that was pretty good. The means of which how the possession takes place, though, is just okay. But I love the setup with the whole similarities to Prisoners and stuff like that. And the movie's great up until the legacy character of Ellen Burstyn shows up. When she shows up, it just goes straight to Blandsville, and I just don't understand it. But we'll get to that in a second. And there is a synthwave version or variation of Tubular Bells that gets played in here that I really enjoyed. I actually thought that was good. It kind of gave me chills, honestly, because I just wasn't really expecting it. It wasn't quite the quality like what we got with John Carpenter and Cody Carpenter and company that did the stuff for all the Halloween sequels and stuff that David Gordon Green did, but it was still pretty cool. And unfortunately, that's where my positives, that's where they end. This movie's, it's completely predictable after the first third of the movie. The first third of this movie, or the first act of this movie, is reminds me so much of Prisoners, and it sets up this movie greatly, because that movie's awesome. And then once the girls are found, it's pretty much predictability and downhill from there. And it's, again, particular in the moment when Ellen Burstyn shows up, which brings me to my next point. She is completely wasted in this movie, and I mean completely. I mean, she's just used as like this small tie back to the original film. And I mean just a literal small tie. And she might be in the movie for 10 minutes, at the most 10 minutes. And she's definitely phoning in her performance, which is a shame on her. And I know y'all are going to say, don't attack the legend, don't attack her, she's 90-something years old. But I have a problem with any actor. I don't give a shit who they are. They could be anybody, Anthony Hopkins. It could be anybody that I hold in high regard. If you come in, you phone in a performance, I'm going to give you shit about it. Because you took the money, and if you took the damn money, put some effort into it. Don't half-ass do it. And she's just there. And, yeah, again, I don't give a fuck if y'all think she's a legend, that she phoned it in. And that's not necessarily, I'm not necessarily coming at her for this movie being bad, but she took the damn money. She needed to, you know, give a decent performance. She just was there. And she had this line in the movie, and I'm in no means blaming this on her, because I'm pretty sure this is what she was given in her script. There is this line in the movie, and this kind of furthers my evidence that she's phoning this in. There is a line in her, when we first meet or reintroduced to her, where she explains that she wasn't even present during her daughter's exorcism, which she wasn't. And she said that the priest told me that it would be too dangerous for me. And I just, in my honest opinion, you really want to know? I think it was because I wasn't part of their damn patriarchy. My God, woman. The fact that she said that damn line and didn't like say, no, I'm not saying this line, is a problem for me. Now, listen, I'm not getting into political shit and all that. That's just, you know how I am on this show. People can believe what they want to believe, and they can have any kind of political affiliation they want to. I do not care. But this is an example of when people, the thing I hate hearing the most is, this is woke. This is woke. That's woke. Not everything is woke. And I don't need to hear that term for everything. It's a throwaway term. But that line is one of those lines that people point directly to and say, look how woke this is. It's like they just shoehorned it in there. And I'm sorry, the reason why I think she phoned it in is because she is a legacy character. She was a star in the original film. And that kind of tanks the legacy of that original film to me, because in the story, those two priests gave their life to save your daughter, lady. It's unrealistic that you would say something that callous and stupid. So the fact that she even said that line and agreed to say it and took the money in this role and phoned it in kind of speaks volumes about this whole situation. Yeah, I know, guys, I'm attacking a legend and all that. I don't give a shit. It was phoned in. Which leads me to the next point. The writing, and particularly the dialogue, it was bad at times. And again, the patriarchy comment, that was just flat out stupid. This plot is what I call a dime a dozen plot for Exorcist films. From that point on, it becomes every Exorcism movie we've seen since The Exorcist. And it's just so damn bland. And I've heard a lot of people say studio produced, as in, yeah, it's studio produced, obviously, but it's like the studio just dusted off generic Exorcism script and plugged it right here. And it wasn't terrible. It was just so generic. And the ending exorcism part, I do think that some part of that, the way that they structured it, was interesting. And it wasn't a bad idea. I just felt like it was poorly executed. And before I move on to my next point, who's the demon that's possessing the two girls? Now, I'm pretty sure a lot of people are going to be like, dumbass, it's Pazuzu. When did they ever say that it was Pazuzu? I do not remember any point in that movie where Pazuzu was even hinted. The only time that we got an inkling of a hint was when Chris and the demon interact with each other when she's inside Olivia O'Neill. And all they say is, we know who you are. How are you, mother? Are you looking for Reagan? That's literally the interaction that's the interaction that they have that could even remotely be pointed back to, hey, this is the same demon. This is Pazuzu. We're never told who the demon is. At least I don't remember. If they did, my bad. I don't remember them ever saying Pazuzu's back or this is Pazuzu. And that was kind of disappointing too, because again, if we're doing a legacy sequel, you got to have more ties than just a 10-minute portion of the movie, 10-minute runtime of the movie that features a legacy character. But I digress. As far back to the exorcism ending, again, good. I thought they had good ideas, but it was poorly executed because it circles back around to this. David Gordon Green recycles this community narrative that he had in his Halloween trilogy, and it works for the Halloween trilogy because the town of Haddonfield had been terrorized by Michael Myers for generations. It made sense for a sense of community and for an entire town to rise up to face off against that evil. Yeah, I know, evil dies tonight. Everybody hates that shit. But it makes sense. It makes no sense in this. No, there isn't one, not one situation where these different branches of religion or different religion sects come together to fight two demons, and the people in the room, majority of them don't know these two little girls. They have no connection with them whatsoever. So they're going to put their complete lives and their soul on the line to fight two demons for two girls they don't know and have no connection with. It's just not realistic, guys. I know that there's good people out there that'd give you the shirt off their back and they'd risk their lives for normal people. But let's be serious. The community thing is just silly at this point. And moving on, speaking of David Gordon Green, Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, they aren't the directors nor the writers suited for this movie or franchise. And look, I'm going to defend both of them right now. 2018, Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills are two of the best sequels in that entire franchise. They're easily in the top five. Easily top half for you tough critics out there. They're two of the best made ones. They're good. Yeah, they got their flaws. No movie's perfect, but they're good. They're better than majority of the franchise. Halloween Ends is a pile of shit. It has redeeming qualities, though, when it comes from certain standpoints. It's not how they handle Myers, but it does have redeeming qualities. But I did not like it. Made my worst of list last year. But it's not completely horrible. It's not the worst of the franchise. They're completely capable of doing Halloween or another slasher franchise, but not this. They really needed like someone who could understand the source material and know how to like respectfully recapture that magic that the first film brought and build on it in a unique way. And I don't know if they're playing the long game like they did with 2018 and Kills, because to me, Kills made 2018 even better because they played the long game with certain plot threads. But in my opinion, if they were going to find somebody that was going to capture that magic of the first film, they should have got Mike Flanagan to do this. If you aren't watching what Mike Flanagan is doing with Stephen King properties right now, or what he's doing with Edgar Allan Poe, what he's doing with original properties, with, you know, all this, everything that Mike Flanagan touches is gold. All of it's good. He hasn't made one bad thing yet. Everything is good. Everything he touches is gold. Mike Flanagan was perfect to do this. And I guarantee you they didn't even give him a call. And maybe contractually they couldn't do it. Maybe David Gordon Green and them are under contract. But to my knowledge, studios can tell you, fuck off, well, you do what we tell you to do if you want something. They don't get to choose what they do. But I'm not in the business, so I don't know. Mike Flanagan would have been perfect for this. Because he would have found a way to respect the original and bring something new and refreshing to the table. Which brings me to my number one point about this whole situation. The Exorcist should have never been a franchise. Ever. And as much as I like The Exorcist 3, I love that movie. I think it's just as good as the original. And some people might think that's blasphemy, but that movie's great. It has George C. Scott. It has Brad Dourif. Both of them give phenomenal performances, especially Brad Dourif. Brad Dourif may give his best performance of his career in that movie. He is scary as hell. He scares the shit out of me in that movie. Not to mention, speaking of scares, The Exorcist 3 has the greatest jump scare of all time. I know that scare's coming, and I still can't get prepared for it. It is that effective and that well done. And even so, I still don't think that The Exorcist should have ever been a franchise. Ever. So that in line is the problem right there. And I'm just going to reiterate, Blumhouse paid $400 million for the rights to this franchise. That is fucking incredible to bring us this. Blumhouse, I've said on here before and I'll say it again, Blumhouse is the face of horror right now. I know people want to say A24. I think A24 is probably next in line. Then probably Paramount. And then probably Warner Brothers. But Blumhouse's approach, they are like, it's almost insulting to say this because I don't think it's this bad. But Blumhouse is like the Walmart of horror. Because they produce quantity more than they do quality. Now, granted, Blumhouse, let's say they put out 30 films a year, 30 horror films a year. 10 of them are going to be great. And about 5 to 10 are going to be okay. And then the rest are going to be generic trash. Whereas A24 over here is going to put out 5 classics or five, let's just say they're going to put out 3 classics, modern classics, and they'll put out 2 masterpieces. And then the rest is turn your pinky up. I'm too smart for you. You're not smart enough to watch this movie bullshit. I still believe in that. I still believe that Blumhouse is the face of horror right now as far as studios producing horror. And I will take that rather than not take it. We need Blumhouse. No matter how much they piss us off, or especially hardcore fans. This wasn't nearly as offensive to me as it is for some fans of The Exorcist. I think that The Exorcist franchise overall is shit. It's one of the worst franchises in horror. It has 2 good movies in it. 2 good movies. 1 excellent, 1 really good, and then it goes from just okay to shit after that. And the TV show is not bad either. But it went nowhere, obviously. I just feel like I just want Blumhouse to focus more on quality than quantity, even though they're kind of keeping horror alive right now. They're kind of like the Amco Embassy or Vestron Studios of horror for the present day, like it was back in the 80s. So I appreciate what they've done. Canon Films, that's another one. They're kind of like those, and I appreciate that. I really do. But they gotta start taking these, just like with what I said with Pet Sematary Bloodlines, stop making these lifeless and soulless legacy sequels. Put some thought into it. Put some quality into this. This movie wasn't a horrible movie. It just wasn't a good Exorcist sequel at all. So with that being said, The Exorcist Believer, I think it's well made, I think it's well shot, and it's a well edited film, and it has good performances by Leslie Odom Jr., Lydia Jouett, and Olivia O'Neill. But unfortunately, that doesn't qualify it to be good or even a decent legacy sequel. Neither does it qualify for throwing in a legacy character to have a poorly attempted tie-in to the original. But what's even more problematic with this is the lack of heart, soul, and uniqueness. Thus, I have very little faith in the next installment. Yeah, I went there. I have little faith in the next installment. So that being said, Exorcist Believer gets a 2.5 out of 5 and is not Grizzly grade guaranteed. And I know that this has been a very negative and rant-filled, just shit-talking episode. But don't worry, y'all. The end of this episode is going to be good. It's not all gloom and doom. I've got a pretty good one for y'all. So let's get to Totally Killer. So Totally Killer is this slasher comedy that is on Amazon Prime right now that stars Kiernan Sepka as Jamie. That's the girl from who plays Sabrina in the new Sabrina show. And she's from this small town that has this murderous past where in 1987, starting on October 27th, this mass killer called the Sweet 16 Killer murdered three of her mother's friends by stabbing him 16 times on the night of their birthdays. But he never came for her mother until 36 years later, when the killer brutally murders her mom, and then he comes after her a few days later. So when he comes after her in a desperate attempt to escape from her, she climbs into her best friend's science project, which turns out to be a makeshift time machine, thus sending her back in time to a couple of days before the murders occur back in 1987, and now Jamie is desperately trying to save everyone from the killer and, of course, save her mom. But she is a Gen Z in the land of Gen Xers, and it's hilarious. So let's get to the positive on it. This was such a surprise, and I really enjoyed this. Let's just get to all the positives. All the performances are great. There is no bad performances. Kiernan Sepka is, of course, the standout. And I like all of the past counterparts of the adults from the present day. All those kids did great. And I think this movie did a good job of making those kids look like their past counterparts too. They did good casting on that as well. The story and the plot, it's Back to the Future meets Friday the 13th, and they execute that to perfection. It really nails the 80s aspect, and it actually handles time travel very, very well, to the point that it doesn't get confusing. They don't try to make it too complicated, because most movies that deal with time travel, they write themselves in a hole. Or either time travel is used to take somebody who's written themselves in a corner and kind of hand wave their way out of it. This movie does that good. It doesn't bring in all these possibilities or anything. It doesn't really establish any rules, but it's just simple. She has a goal to stop the killer, to prevent all these murders from happening so that she can save her mom. Along the way, certain things could affect the future, but it's nothing like destroy the whole space-time continuum or nothing like that. And I think that was very brilliantly handled, because it could have easily just turned into this mess of a plot because of it. The dialogue and the writing is great. A Gen Zer in the 1980s, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. I was expecting them to, like, if you would have told me this, I would have expected it to be something like, take one of those assholes from the movie Bodies, 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 and put them in a situation like, I don't know, a movie like Weird Science. It just wouldn't work. It would just be so annoying, and I would just be ready for the damn movie to be over with. But they handle it so damn well, and it's so great to see that they handle it well. It's not annoying at all. And the interactions are amazing. Jamie, Kieran Septa's character, she doesn't come off as annoying whatsoever. Like the stuff that she says that a Gen Zer would absolutely say to someone from the 80s just blows my mind. There's a scene where she has like this cloth and it's got the killer's blood on it, and she hands it to the cop and she's like, here's DNA evidence for the killer. And the cop looks at her and is like, the fuck are you talking about? What is DNA? Like, she's totally unaware that stuff like that doesn't exist yet. And I thought that was so freaking hilarious. Or she goes to the cops and they're like, get the hell out of here. You know, you this ain't Terminator or some shit like that. It's done very well. Someone comes up and like pushes her and she's just like, oh, unwanted touch. Shit like that. That should annoy me, but is delivered so well that it doesn't. And I thought that was so well handled. And speaking of that, the comedy's on point. This movie will have you laughing. It'll have you laughing from the mean girl aspect of her past mom and her friends, to again all the Gen Z comments, to Gen Xers that are like, what? No, like they all their interactions, all of it's hilarious. I thought that all was handled so well. And finally, the killer and the killer's mask before the reveal. The killer's creepy, and he seems like at one point he seems very, I'm not going to say unstoppable, but he is like this. The Sweet 16 killer is very reminiscent of slasher villains from the 80s. They did a good job of making him feel like an 80s slasher villain. Like, you don't know if he's immortal or not, but he's seemingly unstoppable. He's very capable, and every time you try to stand up for him, he just whips your ass and kills you. And I felt like they did a pretty damn good job of making him look menacing. His mask is creepy as shit. And it kind of looks like, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get this right, but to me, when I seen that mask, it looks like Brian Bosworth. If y'all know who Brian Bosworth was, he was a football player from Oklahoma, I believe, that went on in the NFL and was this big personality. They called him the Boz because he was this big muscle-bound guy with this flat-top type haircut and this earring. He's probably a prominent 80s movie character mask that I just couldn't place at the time. But that's who he looks like to me. He looks like a Brian Bosworth mask, and I liked it a lot. I think they did a good job of making him look big and menacing. And honestly, I don't have many negatives for this movie. I do like the look of the killer and the menacing nature of the killer. But honestly, the killer is very predictable, and quite frankly, once the reveal is confirmed, it's unbelievable. He's very strong and capable. So like killer. So when they finally reveal who it was, it just wasn't believable. There's no way that the person that they reveal it to be is just no selling everything that they throw at him. Like, yeah, I know it's kids, but I understand that it's kids, and a grown person can whoop a kid's ass, and I get that, but not when there's a lot of people around. He's not going to no-sell everything like Terminator, and that's kind of like one of the things that this killer does. And then when you get the reveal, it's like, what the fuck? And it's a very hand-wavy explanation on how he was able to be so capable and so strong. And I just didn't like that part. I felt like it kind of tainted, like, you know, possibly a newer, you know, face of horror that we could add to, like, big group collages and stuff of all these horror villains. The other thing that was pretty weak was the kills overall are just tame and very lame. The first kill of the film is the best, because it just seems mean. And the whole MO of this killer is he stabs his victim 16 times. But I wanted a little more. I appreciate variety and creativity with my kills, and this movie just didn't have that. It doesn't lack gore, and it doesn't lack like any kind of blood or tension because of it. But they're just not creative kills. They're just stabby, stabby kills like Scream. It's very similar to Scream. So I probably should say Back to the Future meets Scream. But it's closer to Friday the 13th because of how unbeatable the killer is. And finally, my small little detail gripe that I have is I wanted more out of the ending. So when everything's all said and done, I just wanted, like, there was a lot of this, 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 and that's it. And I really wanted more of you change this and this and this. Because when you go into patch, you change stuff, obviously something happens. I wanted some more impactful, more emotional stuff to happen. And a little more in-depth in of the ramifications of time travel. And we just didn't get that. And that necessarily wasn't a horrible thing. It was just, I just wanted a little bit more, would have been a little icing on the cake. But Totally Killer is, it's Back to the Future meets Friday the 13th, and it's executed to near perfection. And what it lacks in creative kills and a strong killer reveal is completely compensated with great writing, good performances, hilarious comedy, and a perfectly done comparison of commentary between Generation Z and Gen X. So with all that being said, Totally Killer gets a 4 out of 5 and is Grizzly grade guaranteed. Told y'all it's going to end on a good note. Go watch this movie. It is currently on Amazon Prime, and I really enjoyed this. Will it make my top 25 list of the year? Time will only tell, but I really did enjoy it. This year has not been the best year for horror so far. It's a big drop off from last year, which was just hit after hit after hit. But this one was very enjoyable, and especially enjoyable for it being a low budget and once again a Blumhouse production. And that's what this is, a perfect example of what I'm saying. They shit the bed on The Exorcist, but then they delivered one of these little gems right here that's very similar to some of their earlier stuff like Happy Death Day and Freaky, which I liked both of those as well. I like this one better than Happy Death Day. Don't know if I liked it more than Freaky, but I did like it more than Happy Death Day. I felt like this was great. And, I mean, Back to the Future is my favorite movie of all time. And then you pair that with Friday the 13th and you execute it good, I'm there every time. It's pretty good. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. And with that, we bring another episode to an end. Thank you all so much for your continued support. Without y'all, the show isn't possible. If you like this episode, please consider subscribing to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to click the links in the description below to follow me on all social media platforms. All right, we're going to go back to brews and reviews this week. Coming up, going to bring you the last of mine and Jacob Gotham's Dead Trilogy series. And looking forward to that. That was awesome. I really enjoyed putting that series together. Then I'm going to be working on the Halloween special for this year. And even though Halloween's celebrating its 45th anniversary, I'm going to take a rest from the Halloween franchise and do something different this year. I'm going to bring you another, in my opinion, Halloween classic, a must viewing for every spooky season. And I'm going to wait to reveal that when I drop that episode. Still working on something special. I'm going to try to get it out to y'all. Hopefully it's going to work out. If not, it will just be pushed back and it'll be released when it can be. So just stay tuned for that. Make sure you go and check out Carl Casey at White Bat Audio. He's the one that does all the music for the intros, outros, and the music within the episode. Guys, stuff is great. He's available on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube and anywhere that you can download music from. Check this guy's stuff out. If you love synthwave, there's no reason why you shouldn't be listening to Carl Casey at White Bat Audio. I hope everybody's having a good spooky season. I'm enjoying the hell out of mine so far. Thank y'all again for your time and patience. I appreciate y'all. Without y'all, the show isn't possible. And remember, I'm Joe Grizzly, bitch.